Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Do you need a special skill to do something extraordinary? Or maybe you just need passion, a drive to keep going when other people would have stopped. We're talking this hour about the kind of passion that motivates a sculptor to build a tableau honoring Olympians out of butter. Or the determination to not let deafness derail your leadership goals. Or the inspiration to write a book about skate parks in the Midwest. Joining me now is journalist, essayist, and award-winning poet, Mandy Shannara. Their debut novel is Midwest Shreds, Skating Through America's Heartland. Welcome to All Sides, Mandy.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I think about skating, I am a woman of a certain age, so I think about Tony Hawk and Southern California. I don't think about Ohio. What is it about the Midwest that makes us such a unique place for skating?
Yeah, and I think you're not alone in the defaulting to California and Tony Hawk when you imagine skaters. And what makes the Midwest special and was so fun to research for this book is the Midwest were the ones who were patenting the parts, designing the parts, manufacturing the skates, assembling everything and putting it together. And we're making innovations in things like polyurethane wheels, for example, that made it much easier to skate outside, because before that, wheels were clay. And if you tried to skate outside on, say, a gravelly road, they would just fall apart. So the Midwest had a huge impact on the actual making of skates and their component parts that then the people in Southern California called up the factories in the Midwest, ordered the parts, and affixed them to planks to make skateboards. And then they're the ones who were, while the Midwest was making the skate components, Californians were pushing the limits of what could be done in this sport. So they had all these empty pools by nature of it being warmer weather, and they are, you know, using their cameras and camcorders to really capture this compelling imagery, like the image of the person airing out of the bowl that's very visually compelling. So because of how compelling that visual imagery was, it turned into, oh, only people over here do this. And all the Midwest contributions got thrown to the side.
The book seems to stem from your own passion for skating and your desire to learn about skating culture. So I got to ask, how did you come to it? How did you get into it? Do you still skate?
I do still skate, even after a really nasty ankle break about a year ago. I just can't keep wheels off my feet. But how I came to it was I grew up in rural Alabama, and there were no skate parks around. This was in the pre-YouTube days, so I'm telling my age a little bit.
That's okay.
But I would watch intently when shows like Viva La Bam and Jack, I don't even know if I can say half on the radio.
I know what show you're talking about with Bam Margera and all
yes.
of them.
Yes. And so I want to say that I do not recommend these shows, but watching them as a kid was the first time that I conceived of the notion that you could be a professional skate athlete, and that was a career path. And so not having access, I thought, I'm going to watch their feet really intently. There's no skate parks or skate shops in rural Alabama, so I'm going to go to Walmart and get a board and just do the best I can in my driveway. And it cemented this lifelong fascination with this action sport.
So when did you know that you wanted to write a book all about skating here in the Midwest?
The funny thing is, if you had told me, I've wanted to be a writer since I was 5 years old, but if you had told me that my first book would be in the sports category, I would have laughed. I didn't set out to write a book about skating. It just kind of happened, more or less. I have to shout out my ex-husband who told me, like, hey, you love to write, you love skating, why don't you write about skating? And I kept telling him, nah, I'm good. I don't need to do that. And he finally hounded me enough that I agreed to write one article about it, because I'm also a freelance journalist. And then that turned into a book when I realized that this was going to be way longer than an article.
The book is called Midwest Shreds, and it details your travels across the Midwest to learn about how people in local communities skate. You have a bunch of different stories collected in the book. How did you land on this format of essentially you take us on a road trip through the Midwest?
Yeah, so I knew I didn't just want to talk about Ohio and that there were so many more stories beyond my own. And if I was really going to do it justice as a corrective history and not just talk about white dudes on skateboards, which is the predominant image that you think of, then I really needed to get on the road and meet people. And so I just, from being entrenched in the community myself as someone who's traveled a good bit to go skate other places and knowing that a bunch of us connect on Instagram, I just started reaching out and putting out feelers and saying, who do you know in these places who are doing cool things in the skate world? And then got connected to this plethora of fantastic people who are all making the world a better place in some way through the lens of skating.
The book covers states like Ohio, Indiana, Minnesota, and more. Were there specific stories that stuck out to you, favorite moments from the book?
Oh my gosh. Getting to go to Lauridsen Skate Park in Des Moines, Iowa, which is now the largest skate park in the country. It's 88,000 square feet. And to see such a significant investment from the city and for them to really embrace skaters and make skate tourism a thing instead of just saying, oh, these are quote-unquote delinquents, these are riffraff, we want to push them off to the side, like a lot of city governments have historically done. And I arrived in Des Moines, I think 3 days after Lauridsen had officially opened, and they were having the Dew Tour, sponsored by Mountain Dew, which is like a huge competition in the skate world. And it was the only Olympic qualifying skateboarding event in North America.
Oh my goodness.
And it was for the 2020 Olympics, which of course, because of the coronavirus, was in 2021. But I got to witness that. And that included a wheelchair skating athlete who's one of the best in the world, who's from the Midwest. And I got to see her perform and talk to her. And that was particularly memorable because she's doing some incredible things. Her name is Tia Pearl.
Yeah, it's, you know, what's so fascinating to me is a child of probably the same era as you, since I remember Johnny Knoxville quite clearly, is that so much has changed. Because when Tony Hawk was coming up, when he was making a name for himself, it was done in these abandoned pools. It was done in a subversive way. It was done in public places. And now it's part of the Olympics. It is professionalized. It, you know, snowboarding kind of came up along at the same time. It has been wild for me to watch the arc of sports like this over the last 30 years.
Oh, yeah. And we're very much in a moment of transition. So while skateboarding, you could argue, is mainstream now, officially with it being in the Olympics, roller skating and on ramps just made its X Games debut just earlier this summer.
Which is kind of crazy if you think about it.
Right, because they've been doing rollerblading for a while, but I guess there just wasn't enough popularity with quad skates on ramps until recently for them to justify adding it.
I have a real soft spot for roller derby, so.
Yes.
Which is a whole other kind of skating.
But there's a crossover. A lot of the roller skaters who came to ramps started with derby.
One of the places you visited here in Ohio is Skatetopia. It's an 88-acre skate park in Meigs County. What was your experience like visiting that place?
It was certainly interesting. So for those who don't know about Skatetopia, it is an anarchist commune that is run by retired former professional skateboarder Bruce Martin, and it is notorious for its wild and raucous parties. I will say there's a reason this man has been imprisoned multiple times, and so I was absolutely terrified at the idea of showing up to this place. There's a documentary about it, and they burn people's cars, so I had to, every moment that I was there, I wanted to think very strategically about my own safety, including parking really close to the skateboard museum, because I reasoned if they burn my car, they'll also have to take out the skateboard museum.
That's a heck of a thought as like a journalist or a writer. You're like, where do I park so they don't burn my car?
Yeah, but interestingly enough, because I had been trying to get an interview with him for months and months and months, and he was kind of putting me off. And so I just showed up one day and said, you know, I'm going to surprise him. And it turned out that he was actually in prison at the time, which at the time I was like, oh no, what am I going to do? But it worked. The journalism gods blessed me that day because I ended up talking to this guy who has lived on the property for years and really manages the place and helps build the ramps. And he ended up being such a surprisingly compelling character that it was a lovely day. And it also just so happened that the day I went, it was 96 degrees. I was the only skater there. No one else wanted to sweat that much.
Yeah. It also, as you mentioned, has a skateboarding history museum. And it's got a lot of artifacts, a lot of different history about skating. It's kind of strange that at this very rough and tumble place, they also have this museum.
Yeah, and they're very dedicated to showing the earliest skateboards to present day. And I mean, there are, I would hazard a guess that there are at least 3,000 skateboards just shoved in every nook and cranny in this place.
You know, you write about how the Midwest is often overlooked just in general. And I think we know that idea of flyover country. And I think what I love about this is it's sort of saying, hey, not only do we have a role to play in the development of the physical skateboards, but there are some pretty cool and amazing and creative people just from the Midwest in the sport itself.
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite places that I went was in St. Louis to a skate park that, spoiler alert, has now actually burned down. But it was in this old cathedral that was actually, they started building it before Abraham Lincoln was born, and they didn't finish until after he died. And it's this old Gothic cathedral that they just gutted and then put all the skate stuff in. It's actually tall enough that they could have fit a vert ramp in there, which is massive. And I got to see that. And it's almost like a pilgrimage site in the skate community. People are constantly wanting to go to this place. And to be able to see it before it burned and to know
that... Did it
have
the stained glass windows in it?
Yes.
Oh,
they left all the Stations of the Cross were still on the walls. The old stained glass was still there. The beautiful columns. Just, you know, they took out the pews and put ramps.
Oh, my goodness. And you know, one of the things I always think about skateboards, I also think about the art that goes into them. And I know sometimes people don't think about it, but the design, particularly on the underside of the skateboards, I mean, there's a lot of artistry that goes into it. There's people who make a living just designing that artwork.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the really awesome people I interviewed is, he goes by Chemo Supremo. He
Love
is
that.
One of the only Black people who own a skate shop in the country.
Oh,
and
wow.
He's in the Chicagoland area, but how he got his start was buying these blank skateboards, and him and his friends would, they were all artists, so they would decorate them and then sell them as like one-of-a-kind custom decks that, you know, were so beautiful that most people didn't actually skate with them. They hung them on their walls. But that really, you know, he took his love of art and skating and fused them, and then that gave him enough capital to start his skate shop.
Oh my goodness. I love that. It's also really fascinating that he came to it through his art and then got into the act of skating. It sounds like it kind of backed into it through art.
I think he got into both around the same time. So just in his head, they were always connected. So it made sense that he ended up doing both.
Yeah. How do you think the culture of skating has changed as it's gone more mainstream?
I think it's for the best because it's more welcoming. It's more inclusive. You know, there's still this reputation or the stereotype of white dudes on skateboards. But when I go to the park, I'm a not dude. I'm plus size. I'm Arab. I'm queer. I go to the skate park. I see other people like me. I see a lot more BIPOC folks, a lot of visibly queer folks. And it just warms my heart to see because for so long, the world around skate parks and their culture felt so exclusive that it was really intimidating to go to the skate park. And I know the first couple of times I went, I was absolutely terrified. And, you know, I've been heckled, you know, by men who objected to not just my presence as a non-dude, but also my choice of wheels. I roller skate on the ramps, which some people think is really weird. But overall, it has gotten so much more diverse and welcoming. And I think that is absolutely for the best. I want everyone who is curious about the sport to feel safe and comfortable in an environment where they can practice it.
Yeah, my then boyfriend, now husband, got me into dirt bike riding. And that is definitely a male dominated sport. But I got to say, I'm impressed that you keep it up, because honestly, the bumps, the bruises, the being, you know, flung off of a dirt bike at 50 miles an hour, it gets old as you get old.
Well, I can't say I've ever been flung going 50 miles an hour, but I did have like a year and some months ago, a really, really nasty break. I was carving around a bowl and it was a really tight one. So you're going faster just to maintain your speed and balance. And it was even a bowl that I'd been in before. And somehow one minute I'm riding the wall and the next minute I'm on the ground with my leg twisted under me. And I heard the snap, so I knew something was broken.
Oh,
and
that's always the worst.
It was nasty. It was, I can't get that sound out of my head, but I would really like to. But I keep coming back because I think it's something in you that you either have this need for adrenaline or you don't. And unfortunately, for better or worse, I crave that adrenaline.
So where do we find Midwest Shreds? Where do we find you on the internet?
So you can find Midwest Shreds, Skating Through America's Heartland, in any bookstore. It is out in the world now. I've signed copies for most of the local bookstores at this point. So $2 Radio, Bookspace Columbus, Prologue, all have signed copies, assuming they're still in stock, which it would be a great problem to have if they're not. And you can find me at mandyshinara.com. That's my website where you can see more about the book and all of my writing. I'm on Instagram at Off the Beaten Shelf and at Midwest Shreds, because I started a separate skate account for the book. But that's a common thing in the skate community, to have your primary account and your skate account. So,
well, that was Mandy Shinara, author of the new book, Midwest Shreds, Skating Through America's Heartland. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're talking about how to raise money when you can't hear what the other person is saying. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. One of the main priorities for a university president is fundraising, convincing big donors to open their wallets to you and your institution. So how do you do that if you can't hear what those donors are saying? Joining me now to explain how she does it is Antioch College President Jane Fernandez. Welcome to All Sides, President Fernandez.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And serving as our interpreter today is Jennifer Boyd. Thank you for joining us as well. One of the biggest jobs of a college president these days is fundraising, calling on donors for contributions. And Antioch's entire student population receives some form of financial aid. How do you make this work?
Well, all the students at Antioch do get financial aid on some level. And the students are heavily, their families have challenges with finances. So basically, we have to make that work through the federal government Pell Grant program, some federal government work study, and also through the generosity of our alumni and others who donate money to the college. So yes, my big job, biggest part of my job is fundraising and bringing in revenue for the operations of Antioch. We have been successful with that, but we are now in a process of trying to be more expansive about how we raise revenue and the student body as a whole. Just be more expansive. We're working on that.
What drew you to higher education as a career?
Okay, that's a good question. Because I had a lot of challenges in school, and schools, the public schools, are required to serve. But in my age, they didn't do that well. And when I got to college, there was nothing provided. And I understood how hard I had to work and how out of the community I was and how the college was not made for a person like me. But I knew I wanted to be educated. And I am. But I wanted to make sure that every person or every student who wants to go to college can go there and not feel that it's not a place for them. That's my passion. And that's what I do as an ally and advocate.
I understand that you didn't learn American Sign Language until you were a graduate student at the University of Iowa. Were you using lip reading, or how did you get not only through college, but into graduate school?
Well, thank God that I did eventually go to the University of Iowa where I learned American Sign Language. But before that, I was part of an oral education program. And because of my age, I'm rather old. So at that time, all my parents really could do was bring in a teacher. And as my mother herself was deaf, she had a teacher, and I had the same teacher that she had. We did a lot of work at home. From, you know, when I was probably a baby, I don't remember, but from the beginning, we did a lot of work to help me understand that sound is happening and I would best be aware of what is included in that. But I want to say, in hindsight, I was taught to be something that I'm not. You know, at that time, I was taught to be as hearing as possible, to go into a store and never have anyone know that I'm deaf. And really, actually, I did pretty well doing that. But it's part of my higher education mission. A lot of students go to college and they've never been themselves at home. They've just never allowed themselves to be who they are. And they're looking for a place that accepts them. So that's basically what happened when I went to the University of Iowa. But I myself found the deaf people. And then eventually I wrote a dissertation about American Sign Language literature. I changed everything I was doing because once I learned ASL, I knew that who I was. And I knew that I should be proud of that. And I knew that I should help everyone else, not just deaf people, but anyone in that position.
Oh my goodness, I love that. I think there are adults who aren't living as themselves, who go their whole lives without being the people they really wanted to be. How did you decide that you wanted to go for the job at Antioch College? To be the president of the university, the face of the university?
Well, It just kind of happened naturally. I was in a position to get another job as president. I finished my job at Gallaudet College, and I had 1 year to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I might have just gone back to teaching at Guilford, but Antioch College opened up, and I applied. And I received the job, and I want to say being the president of Antioch College is the honor of my lifetime. That college is amazing. And we're working hard to make sure that more people know about the good work that Antioch does for people and students.
Antioch College is in Yellow Springs. It's a tiny private liberal arts college with about 200 students. But its history is rich, and the campus is incredibly diverse. Can you tell us a little more about your university?
I can say that Antioch College is it's an amazing place, the only place I've ever known where the community will do anything to welcome any person, no matter who they are, what they are. They will be welcome at Antioch. And I think it's important to say that at Antioch, identity matters. And I've not ever been in the college where identity mattered that much. Also, we have a great co-op program. It's fortuitous that Ohio is emphasizing work instead of education. It sounds like that sometimes. But Antioch College has a philosophy and belief that work is part of education. So every student at Antioch spends one term working in a place. It could be anywhere in the world, in the country or the world. They go and they have a job where they have a supervisor. They have assignments. They have duties. They get paid. They can be fired. All those things. So when they graduate, they have four jobs on their resume. I mean, it's only one term. Four one-term jobs on their resume. They have supervisors who can make recommendations for them. They know what they want to do. They're ready to go. And it's very high rate of successful and very important jobs that Antioch graduates have. That's a big part of the college.
I love that. As well, in journalism, internships are almost a requirement to graduate. And I will say they represented some of my best education. No shade to my university. My university was fabulous, but I mean, the internships is where I learned so much about how to do the job that I do now.
So may I let you know that Antioch is Antioch College, but it's not Antioch University.
Yes. No, I'm at my personal university where I went to Kent State University.
Oh, but, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's such a hard time, I think, to be the president of a college or the president of a university. You look at what moved through the state legislature in the last year or two that would totally transform the way public colleges and universities work. What is it like to lead a college in this political moment?
So we have so many challenges now, and it's scary to see. I was horrified to see the number of small liberal arts colleges who suddenly closed recently.
Particularly during COVID.
It's a very challenging time. And small liberal arts colleges, to be honest, have been the bastion of higher education in this country. They are the places where students actually have freedom of speech, freedom of protest, freedom of assembly, and they learn what it means to live in a democracy and how to make their cases rationally. I have to believe maybe there's something deliberate about making the small colleges close. I don't know, but it's horrifying. So, yes, Antioch College has the same challenges as everyone does, and we have financial challenges. We are working on, we have developed a social enterprise and enrollment plan, and that focuses on how we can generate diverse sources of revenue, more diverse sources of revenue. And we've done that for 1 year, and it's a 9-year plan to get Antioch to stand on its own feet. and raise the money that it needs, that's enough to run the college. So that's a big job, but we're all dedicated to making that happen. And I want to say Antioch does have some benefits over other colleges because we are very affordable. That's part of our conundrum, because we are very affordable and we want every student who can and wants to be educated to go there. But most colleges charge more tuition, and they use tuition to run the college. So we don't have that benefit. But our social enterprise and enrollment plan has strategies for changing little over time so that eventually we'll be operating on our own 2 feet and not totally dependent on revenue from other people.
That is the inverse of other small liberal arts colleges. They tend to be more expensive even than state schools, even than Ivy League schools sometimes.
Yeah.
It's such a departure from what you think of. I do want to ask, how do you decide when to use your own voice? And what I mean by that is, in preparing for this, I understand when you were president of Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina, lawmakers there passed a bathroom bill similar to what the Ohio House has passed, but won't necessarily become law until after this election. The governor's indicated he might sign it here, and it would apply to both public and private universities. How, you know, you spoke out then. Are you saying anything now? And how would a passage of a bill like this impact Antioch?
I did.
It's a big question.
I was vehemently opposed to HB2 in North Carolina. And that's somewhat part of my role as an ally and advocate for students. In that case, there were a number of students who would be harmed by the bill, and I found it completely unacceptable. So I didn't hesitate to write a statement opposing it. And I don't know, I wish we could do more than that. I know that currently we're facing the possibility of a bill that Governor DeWine supports. I believe I saw him say he supported the bill, which would require people to use the bathroom of the sex on their birth certificates. So what I would say, yes, I do oppose that bill, but what I don't understand, it seems truly unfortunate that Governor DeWine doesn't seem to prioritize the health and wellness of all Ohioans. Because the bill that he's proposing would be harmful to transgender students. And I think everyone agree we all deserve to have safety and wellness. And this bill is antithetical to that. So I know we're not yet ready to pass it, and I hope that over time we can all have conversations, as we do in democracy, try to figure out the way to include everyone in the need to go to the bathroom. That's a basic right. So I think this is really important not to pass the bill and to talk about other ways to make sure everyone can be included when they have to go to the bathroom. Yes, I will work for that to happen.
That was Jane Fernandez, president of Antioch College. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you to our interpreter today, Jennifer Boyd. Coming up, how do you sculpt an Olympic athlete out of 2,000 pounds of butter? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Creating art can always be challenging, even with conventional materials like clay. But when butter is your medium, more than 2,000 pounds of it, that presents a whole different kind of challenge. Paul Brook and a team of sculptors took on that task this year, creating the popular butter cow display for the Ohio State Fair. Welcome to All Sides, Paul.
Thanks.
The theme of the butter cow sculpture each year is often referred to as the fair's best kept secret. It comes out under embargo and gets announced all at once. How did you decide on this year's theme, moving to victory?
I work with the American Dairy Association Mideast, and we start around May, and we see what's going on this year, and usually it relates to Ohio in some way, or to the dairy and the farmers. And we take it from there, and then we brainstorm and come up with the idea and get it ready right before the fair opens.
So moving to victory is an ode to athletes, Olympic athletes in particular. Obviously, we have the Paris Summer Olympics coming up just around the corner. Can you walk us through what you and your team have created? I think we may have a little bit of a technical difficulty with Paul. The butter cow creation features a track and field para athlete. There is a gymnast doing a handstand on a balance beam. There is a high jumper, and there is a cyclist. And I gotta say, the high jumper looked like a particularly challenging sculpture because the athlete pictured is suspended in the air. And you see, like, defined muscles, his forehead wrinkles. There's all these fantastic little details. And it's also a butter sculpture that is physically suspended in the air. So you sort of look at it and you go, A, how on earth did they build that? And B, how do you get it to stay? We are still trying to get a hold of Paul. And, you know, it's... The reason I wanted to do this segment on the butter cow sculptures is also because I think anybody who looks at it and anybody who has ever held butter or worked with butter knows that it's not all that soft and pliable when it's cold, and it's sometimes way too soft when it's room temperature. And just trying to figure out how do you turn butter, which is so persnickety about temperature, into sculptures that not only can stand, but can stand through the entire time that we have the Ohio State Fair. I'm also just super curious about what it would be like to carve in a refrigerator, because obviously you can't carve butter at room temperature. It is the very definition of it. We are still working to get Paul back on the air with us. I understand we're getting him on the phone since he dropped off of our Zoom call. It looks like, Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. I don't know what happened there, but it's
that
trying
is okay.
to reconnect.
So when we dropped the call with you, we were talking about what you have created. And I said that the high jumper, you have four different Olympic athletes featured. The high jumper really surprised me because the athlete is suspended in the air. How did you construct a butter sculpture that could be suspended in the air?
Oh, it's magic. We just came up with the idea that these elite athletes, they push themselves to become those elite athletes, and we thought we would push ourselves to do something kind of crazy, and it worked out. And we do it with armatures underneath and hidden attachments and stuff like that.
So there's like a mesh skeleton underneath the sculpture?
Yeah, there's a steel skeleton basically made of pipes, and there's a little bit of mesh, And we did do a little bit of hollow work on the figures to keep them lightweight so that they could do that gravity-defying pose.
And there's so much detail. So you see the defined muscles, the forehead wrinkles. Do you have traditional training in sculpture, or how do you get that kind of detail in butter?
I do have training in sculpture through the toy industry, which I've been involved in for 30 some years. I've been doing the butter for 25 years now, and it's just a learned process, and there's a pretty big learning curve. We had no idea what we were doing with the butter when we first started, but after 25 years, I've pretty much got it down, and I also have an amazing team who are all good sculptors in their own right, even if it's not their given job. And we do it in a week every year, and it always amazes me when it's done and I could stand back and look at it.
So I got to ask, how do you work with butter? Because, you know, room temperature butter is probably too soft. Butter out of the refrigerator is too hard. What is the perfect temperature for butter sculpting?
That's what you would think. And that's what we found out over a course of years, that room temperature is the proper temperature to start with, because you have an armature inside of a 45-degree cooler. You carry your big box of butter in, it comes in 55-pound boxes, and you can, in room temperature butter, you stick your hands in and grab a huge, giant,
oh my goodness,
5-pound blob of butter and slap it on that armature, and then you just take it from there, and you're inside a 45-degree cooler, so it does cool down pretty quick and become like the stick of butter out of the fridge that we're all used to, and then you can carve it.
Do you have...
It's all depending on the temperature of the butter.
Yeah. Do you have a preference for a kind of butter? Is there a brand of butter you prefer? Or, I mean, with 2,000 pounds of butter, I guess what I'm asking is, how much does consistency matter?
Butter is pretty much butter. We've gotten it from some different sources, but we always use unsalted butter because salted butter does not sculpt well.
Huh, that is good to know. What happens to all of that butter once the fair is over? Because I imagine where does it go?
Yeah, I know. It's weird to think about, but I'm not usually there when that happens. But I think that they hire some kids to go in and scrape as much butter as they can off of the armatures. Then they take the armatures outside the cooler and pressure wash them, I believe. And the amount of butter that they try to keep goes to a recycling facility, and it's used to make various kinds of lubricants and stuff like that.
So it doesn't go, like, people aren't eating the butter afterwards.
No, I didn't think they would be. And it doesn't go completely to waste, and it doesn't go down the drain anywhere. So, yeah, it's recycled.
No, I think that's good. I was, because 2,000 pounds of butter, that's a lot of butter.
Yeah, it really is. And it's once a year, and I think they get butter that's kind of almost past its prime when they do order the butter. And we do usually get a little over a ton to make our sculptures.
Are you using typical clay sculpting tools, like the little scrapers and the knives? Like, is it similar in that sense in terms of the tools?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, those little scrapers are called ribs, and we have serrated ones and smooth ones. And we do pretty much use regular clay tools. Of course, they get all gooped up with butter, and you got to keep washing them off.
Oh, that makes a good point. Yeah, especially if it gets warm and it starts melting.
Yeah, well, we try not to let that happen, but we have had power outages in the past, and that can be bad. If your 45-degree temperature goes up, your sculptures might come down.
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't even considered what would happen if the power went out. You could destroy hours worth of work.
Oh, yeah, ruined in a matter of hours. So we have a backup generator for our cooler, and it's used once in a while.
So you don't carve on site? The sculptures are transported to the fair?
Oh, no, no. We do carve on site.
Okay.
We work inside the dairy building. Ohio State Fairgrounds has a beautiful old dairy building, I think built in 1900. And the cooler is inside that building. And it's a 40 by 10 foot cooler with four big glass windows. So people come in and they view the sculpture that way.
But nobody's allowed to watch you work since the theme each year is kept secret.
Correct.
How many hours go into this? Like collectively, how many hours do you think you and your team have put into this year's sculptures?
We usually try to gauge that and guesstimate it. And I think it's usually around 2,000 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe a little less.
I mean, yeah, if you think about it, you have four Olympic athletes that you did. You even have cows and a calf, both of whom I will note are wearing medals in the sculpture. So I appreciate that attention to detail.
Yeah. We have a guy that helps with the cow, does most of the cow, who's an actual Ohio dairy farmer.
Really?
And he takes a little vacation every year. His name's Matt Davidson, and he takes a little vacation every year to come help us. We spend about a week in Columbus, five of us. And this year we have a couple of helpers from OSU art department come and help us as interns.
Oh, that's awesome. He would also probably be very well familiar with the anatomy and structure of a cow as somebody who works with him every day.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to ask.
He's got it down to the veins on the udder and the fur on the tail and everything.
Yeah, if you guys get a chance to go to the Ohio State Fair and look at the butter cow sculptures, I'm always amazed at that attention to detail down to.
Thank you.
It's fascinating. It's no different than any other sculpture. It's just in butter.
Yeah, it's a big full size display, and it takes about a week. And we love doing it every year. It's a great tradition in Ohio, and I'm really happy to be part of it for 25 years.
Having been a part of it for 25 years, have you had a favorite theme or a particular sculpture that you, I don't want to say that you had a favorite, but that maybe you loved a little bit more than the others?
Well, I do. And it was when we did the Toy Story movie. I think it was the 35th anniversary, and that movie was filmed in Cleveland, even though it doesn't take place in it's in a fictional city, I think. But yeah, we did the little guy in the bunny suit and the leg lamp and the kid with his tongue stuck to the flagpole. And I think the calf also had his tongue stuck to the flagpole that year. And we did a butter Christmas tree with real Christmas tree lights.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea that you did a Christmas story in butter. That is... Oh, I wish I could have seen that. I'll have to go search for photographs of it.
Oh, it's on YouTube. You can find it.
What made you guys decide to include a para athlete this year?
I just thought it would be better to include her and be all inclusive. And yeah, it just seemed like the thing to do.
So in... You know, the lead up to the Ohio State Fair, I have seen groups or friend groups get together and try to do their own like butter cow sculpting. Do you have any tips for those of us that are looking to win our like office sculpting competition?
Ooh, I have tried to do little sculpts without the 45 degree cooler, and it's very difficult. If you can find a real cool place to get inside and sculpt in there, that would be beneficial. If not, just stick it in the fridge when it starts to fall apart and let it cool down.
Do you ever go to the fair during these events and watch people react to the sculptures?
Yeah, I have. Well, of course, I go every year for the grand opening, but that's a day before the actual fair opening. But when the kids were little, we'd go, and it's hot there, and
very
there's
hot.
A lot to do. But yeah, the butter cow is a favorite for everyone, and I'd love to go see it.
That was Paul Brook, the lead sculptor for this year's butter cow display at the Ohio State Fair. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
And I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron S. Montrabinowitz, intern producers Abigail Jump and Kira Ketter. Board production this hour was by Chris Johnston. And thank you so much for listening to All Sides with Anna Staver right here on 89.7 NPR News.